dead comes home, then you must be smarter than your enemy.
What are you trying to say?
The Americans, they're very smart, but sometimes they can be incredibly stupid. They spend all this money and time and energy on the so-called war on terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation over 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens? There's a new one before the body's cold. You do it a million times. They never get it because the real solution always eludes them. What is? Do nothing. If you want to shut down a fundamentally flawed system, all you gotta do is step out of its way, and it'll shut itself down. Nature has a way of correcting itself.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance radio calling. This is Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in north central Indiana. On the July the 16th, 2015, Thursday, I like the sound of that, Thursday, yeah, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the show and other projects, and also your snail mail to Box 401. And also, you can drop into Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse once in a while and have a beer. Or go around and kick the tank tracks on our weapons of mass destruction used equipment yard out here. We're getting more and more good stuff in here all the time. Uncle Sammy flies his equipment around the world and then it just sits there and nobody uses it. A lot of times it's still in the packing crates. And we get them back here and offer them to you at cheap prices. If they got any bullet holes in them, we'll bondo them up. We got Jose down the street. He can bondo them up for me and give you a good deal. And if you're a lady and you want a pink tank, we'll give you a free paint job. Yeah. Pretty big of us, huh? Well, how are all you Trumpites doing? They're going crazy over Donald Trump. Well, they need something like this. The Republican Party needs something to jazz up their followers. So this is a good thing. It's a lot of fun. Everybody's going to have a lot of fun. But in the end, it'll be the same old shit. They manage to come up with a stage show every 4 years, man. Every 4 years, they come up with a stage show. And then all the little sheeples run out there, get all excited, and boy, we're going to change things. We're going to change things. Just like remember Obama, we're going to have transparency. Well, I could see through him real easy, but that's not what I meant by transparency. You know, the one thing out of many that pisses me off, simple. The right and the left wing, they both react the same way. Over different subjects, of course, and different philosophies. But they've got the idea that their enemy always lies. And that's very far from the truth. Your enemy tells you the truth more than he lies. And so I get these guys in the right wing that they're always trying to clean up Hitler's act. And sometimes they help a little bit. But anytime, just because he was on the losing side, allegedly the losing side, they say that, anybody that says anything bad about Hitler is lying. And the other side says anybody that says anything good about Hitler is lying. When in fact, at least half of what they say on both sides is true. I put out the information about Hitler having been shot up with methamphetamine concoctions by Dr. Morrell, who everybody around in Hitler's staff hated. Morrell knew he was a quack. He'd been identified as a quack. But now I get guys who say, oh no, he was a fine doctor, and he only gave Hitler stuff that was not dangerous to Hitler. Didn't give him monkey glands and all that methamphetamines. At this point in the game, it really doesn't make any difference, as far as I'm concerned. But it's amazing how guys on the right will send me stuff all the time that shows Hitler was always right. He never did anything wrong. He never made any mistakes. He was brilliant. But he lost. And the other side just keeps repeating, he was evil, he was horrible, nothing he ever did was right, and blah, 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 blah. The truth is about right down the middle. That's the problem. But like I say, do you notice that? To the right wing, their enemy never tells the truth. That's why they can't really win against their favorite group, the Jews, because they assume the Jews always lie. Well, no, they don't always lie. In fact, they don't lie but maybe less than 50% of the time. I read their Israeli newspapers and so forth. They tell on themselves all the time. Everybody says, oh, those Jews, they're secretive. You don't know what they're doing. Well, that's bullshit, because they brag about everything they're doing. And there's plenty of contrary opinions by a certain section of the Jews in, say, Israel or New York. There's always muckrakers in every group. So you got the right-wing Jews, you got the left-wing Jews, and they're all fighting all the time. And then you got this moron Netanyahu that expects everybody to dogpile on Iran, whereas Iran, just like any other country, is 50% okay and 50% not okay. But logically and morally, how can you keep Iran from having an atomic bomb? Everybody else has got a bomb. Israel's got maybe over 200, huh? We don't know for sure, because they never fess up, never sign any treaties or anything. But they're in a position to always dogpile Iran. And what's the United States doing telling Iran what to do anyhow? It drives me crazy. The United States government goes around the world, just dictates to everybody. No wonder we're hated. Especially the government of this country. Hated all over the world. Because we go in there and just push people around and say, this is what you're going to do. We have no moral authority to tell Iran whether to have an atomic bomb or not. You know, especially after we were the first to use atomic bombs just to test them out on the Japanese as test people, drop it on them. Yeah, they wanted to drop it on the Germans, but the war ended in Europe before they were ready. Yeah. Anyhow, when somebody says your enemy lies all the time, then don't listen to that person, because no enemy lies all the time. No enemy lies 50% of the time. Okay? That if you think in the way I do, then I'm going to look for truth and evidence wherever I find it, no matter whether it's my enemies or not, you learn something. Otherwise, you close your mind off, you never learn a goddamn thing. And when you're looking for truth, you can't be biased. You can't be openly biased. You can't start off with the premise Hitler was a wonderful, great man, a great politician, a great leader, and he obviously, if he's that kind of person, he couldn't do anything wrong. And the opposite. If you start from either end, you can't do research. No legitimate historian is ever going to find out the truth about anything if he approaches everything with that kind of bias. One fellow sent me today a message that was a full page of why Hitler's grandfather wasn't Jewish. I don't give a shit if Hitler's grandfather was Jewish. I mean, I really don't. And I really don't see that that would have made a hell of a lot of difference in the way Hitler acted. I think any problem Hitler had was psychotic. It was something along those lines. I don't think it's because he may have had somebody back in the woodpile that was part Jewish and like that. I think that those kind of arguments bore me. This idea, you know, hey, he's a quarter Jew. Well, which leg? Which arm? The head or the penis? You got to judge people by what they do. You got to judge peoples by what they do or their leaders do. That's the only way to figure anything out. I mean, if somebody's an asshole, do something bad, well, then that's, and you got the evidence, just say that's it. Didn't make much difference where it came from or whether he was a quarter Jew or not. But the right wingers are obsessed with this one half, one quarter, one third Jew thing. And it's, well, anyhow, to me, it's quite funny. It's too bad that Jews weren't colored purple or something, so you could see what content of a Jew was, how Jewish they were. If they were dark purple, they're full-blooded Jew. If they're real light purple, they're maybe a quarter Jew. If they barely see a purple tinge, they'd be 1/16th Jew. Well, I mean, you know, with blacks, black Africans, it's very easy. You know, you can see, if there's very much Negro in them, you can tell either by the lips or the skin and the kinky hair and like that. It's not that hard. But when you go after the Jews, it's a little bit different. And I want to tell you, those Orthodox Jews over there in Israel are whiter than Aryans. They're chalk white. I never seen anybody so white. So what do you do? What do we do about that? Well, I see another black church burn up. Probably more than that. Probably some are not even reported. I think a lot of this has been the collecting the insurance on some of these churches. Authorities responded early Wednesday morning to a fire at Houston's Fifth Ward Missionary Baptist Church, the latest in a rash of burnings at the predominantly black religious institutions. Nobody was injured in the Wednesday fire, but the Texas church was significantly damaged. KHOU reported it took firefighters about 30 minutes to extinguish the flames. So more and more black, either ill-constructed churches or without fire detection alarms or big insurance policies are burning down.
Bank alone.
Whoa! On the other hand, it could be overzealous white people. Who knows? Who knows? But if they don't catch anybody, that means it's probably not whites that are burning the churches down. Because if it's a white that's burning the churches down, they always catch them real quick. Well, Billy Boy Clinton's telling all now. Former President Billy Clinton said his criminal justice policies aimed at reducing violence, quote, made the problem worse for the nation's Negro youth who face face high rates of incarceration. Clinton's mea culpa came during the NAACP's annual national convention in Philadelphia on Wednesday, a day after President Barack Obama called for the overhaul of the nation's law enforcement policies that disproportionately hurt Negro men. Yeah, how about that? Clinton, the last Democrat in the White House before Obama, has taken steps to distance himself from his administration's three strikes criminal justice policy as his wife, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, campaigns for the Democratic nomination for president. Quote, I signed a bill that made the problem worse, and I want to admit it, unquote, he told the NAACP on Wednesday, according to media reports. But he'll be forgiven for putting more and more black boys into prison on the three strikes, give them life, get them off the street. Oh, Bill, how could you be so cruel to the nigger boys? Here's a story of God Needs the Money Man. A Florida church sent a delinquency notice to a new member, reminding her that worshipers were expected to pay $1,000 in required fees or face possible removal, because God needs the money, man. Candace Peterson said she started attending the Greater Mount Moriah Primitive Baptist Church. I like that primitive stuff. About 6 months ago, after moving to a new home in the Tampa area, but she received a troubling letter last week from the church. The single mother said she received what amounted to a delinquency notice from her new church asking her to contribute $50 a month along with other assorted fees to remain a member in good standing and vote on church matters and be loved by the baby Jesus. She's all in a quandary. What can I do? I don't have 50 bucks a week. But remember, God needs the money. Well, the KKK's in business. White KKK. They're distributing neighborhood watch flyers in North Charleston, South Carolina. The flyers read, "You can sleep knowing the Klan is awake." What is motivating the Ku Klux Klan to hand them out in a predominantly black neighborhood? Well, I'm going to tell you, I hate to admit it, but in my travels, having been in contact with the Klan for many years, I found quite a number of Klan members that I wouldn't sleep too well if I know they were roaming around my neighborhood. Yeah, I'll tell you, I could tell you some stories about that. Boy, here's another thing on the Klan. Unbelievable. The KKK has a public image problem. Well, the press created for them. You might assume it has something to do with the whole white supremacy and lynching nigger people thing. And you would be correct. While the Klan hasn't directly addressed that problematic aspect of their platform, they've tried to clean up their image in other ways, most notably through community service. Yeah, here we go. Here we go again. Right now, a Georgia Court of Appeals is deciding whether or not the KKK should be allowed to participate in the state's Adopt-a-Highway program. The KKK petitioned to join the program in 2012, and after being rebuffed, they appealed, sending their case to court. We want to get out on those highways and clean up that nigger garbage and beer cans and used condoms that the niggers throw out the windows of their cars along the highway, and it's absolutely a travesty. And us wonderful Klan people in our white robes, we're going to go out there and clean up the highway. Surprisingly, this is not the first time the KKK has tried to participate in public service. No, they've done it for a long time. And almost without exception, they are legally allowed to do so. Back in 92, Nathan Robb, that's Thomas Robb's son, the one that's running a Confederate flag shop down there in Arkansas. Well, anyhow, he filed to adopt one stretch of the U.S. highway near Harrison, Arkansas. And at the time I said, what a put down for the Klan. The Klan has sunk so low that the only way they can get publicity is to go out and pick up nigger, Mexican, chink garbage off the highways. I'm telling you. Like Bob Miles used to say, it's time to put the Klan to bed. It's way past time to put the Klan to bed. Now in 1998, the KKK, that's the white KKK. I don't think the black KKK is picking up any garbage. Anyhow, they petitioned to adopt a stretch of I-55 in St. Louis. Again, the state initially denied their request, but was overturned in the higher court. Since there was nothing the state of Missouri could do to stop the KKK from picking up nigger garbage, they responded by naming a portion of the Klan's highway the Rosa Prostitute Parks Highway. It gets ridiculous. Later on, when a neo-Nazi group adopted part of a highway near Springfield, the state of Missouri pulled a similar trick, renaming a portion of the highway after Jewish theologian Rabbi Abram Joshua Herzl. That showed him. Boy, did that show him. The reason the KKK pursues issues like this is simple. Oh, adopting a highway is one of the only ways the group could possibly advertise. Oh, yeah? I can think of a lot of ways they can advertise. The media won't sell them ad space. Well, some will. And you got the internet. What do you need with a newspaper anyhow? And people aren't exactly clamoring to have the Klan sponsor their kickball team. That leaves Public Works and the perk of Public Works name recognition. If the state fights it, even better. Well, it's ridiculous. You reach more people in 1 hour on the internet than the Klan could pick up nigger garbage for 100 years. I guess these are still some of these people down south or down east or down west that don't have a computer. Maybe we should take up donations to buy the Klan some used computers so they wouldn't have to go out on the pick up the nigger garbage and they could put their stuff on the internet. Well, let's go back and see if we can finish up the good old days. They were terrible. Disinfection and quarantine. The struggle against disease during the post-Civil War period took two forms, the rational and the theatrical. In the first case, scientists, many at great personal risk, experimented doggedly to isolate the causes. In the second, public health officials splashed disinfectant about the slums to demonstrate vigorous action against pestilence, a measure that proved to be more of a public relations gesture than a success in improving sanitation, because it was the major gateway for immigrants. New York was the most vulnerable to epidemics and outbreaks, albeit not major ones, continued to occur despite the convocation of an imposing Board of Health in 1867. Instead of being served by professional sanitarians, the public was at the mercy of so-called health wardens, political appointees of impressive ignorance. Asked to define hygiene, one of them declared, quote, "It is a mist rising from the wet ground," unquote, confining their health measures to daubing the garbage-filled streets with carbolic acid and chloride. The wardens shrank from entering any slum dwelling suspected of contagion on the excuse that the breaking up of these dens, fever nests, only scatters the pestilence. The real cause of the epidemics, disease, the microorganisms bred in the garbage, was not understood, and diphtheria, scarlet fever, and smallpox flourished, spreading from the slums to the cleaner and less crowded areas. No city dweller was immune from tuberculosis, known as the White Plague, which was accepted as a form of divine affliction. Even as late as 1899, when a pioneer in bacteriology, Dr. Herman Biggs, declared it a preventable disease, he was sharply rebuked by the New York Academy of Medicine. Another measure employed to prevent the spread of epidemics was the quarantining of immigrant ships flying the yellow flag, the international signal of epidemic aboard. Authorities refused to let these vessels land, and often passengers following a strenuous voyage were confined to the hold for many days until the contagion appeared to have subsided. In 1892, after 981 immigrants had been designated to land on Fire Island for further quarantine, they were met by a mob of 1,000 brutal citizens, many of them with arms. For 2 days, they were subjected to every imaginable horror until the National Guard was called out to see that they were landed safely. You see, that was the need of the manufacturers of the day to get more cheap labor into the country. And even though a lot of the cheap labor was bringing in diseases, they would risk that to get more cheap labor. Although one can sympathize with the authorities' position in applying it, quarantine did not stop cholera and was futile against yellow fever, which was transmitted through the mosquito bite. An ordeal for travelers, importers, and ship's personnel, quarantine was merely a gesture to show easily panicked city dwellers that their government was concerned about the safeguarding of public health. Frontier health. Thousands of westward bound pioneers took with them the illusion that no matter how tough it turned out, frontier life would be at least be healthful and free of the epidemics that plagued the East. However, they also took along the germs to destroy that illusion. Smallpox traveled with them to break out in towns and even on thinly settled prairies. With the trails west were studded with crosses warning of cholera, which infested waterholes and brackish streams. But the frontier had indigenous afflictions beyond the epidemics that ranged in effect from nuisance to agony. Chief among these was the malarial fever, known as the ague, which consigned its victims to several chills and trembling. Few escaped a bout with this disease. In fact, it was so elementary a condition of the Western life as to be considered quite normal. "He ain't sick, you only got the ague," was the common remark, spoken less in contempt than in familiarity. Treatment of illness on the frontier largely took the form of homemade remedies. Doctors were scarce and unlikely to be of much help anyway. That the West did not attract the cream of the medical profession was suggested by one homesteader. Quote, "The doctor came every day. He purged, he bled, he blistered, he poked, but he never cured me," unquote. For many patients, whiskey performed yeoman service. It made them dead drunk, and for a people accustomed to hardship, that state came as a cheap, if temporary, relief. Doctors, the country doctor of old, whose image acquires new layers of reverence as a medical practice tends towards dispassionate specialization and computerized diagnosis, was actually no more than a venturesome prescriber. Because his diagnosis was based on guesswork, his therapy was totally unreliable. Sometimes it cured, often it killed. All things being relative, the comparison with today may seem unfair, but even allowing for the state of the art during the 1860s through the 1890s, general practice in the United States was backward, commercial, and often fraudulent. And I imagine they learned most of their newer tactics in the Civil War, treating injured soldiers. The lack of education and the proper licensing exposed the sick to hordes of ignoramuses masquerading as doctors. More a trade than a profession, medicine attracted not the sons of the elite who preferred law or theology, but mediocrities who saw a chance to get rich quick. And even this was not enough to satisfy one graduate who declared, quote, "Hell, if I'd have had a known a feller had to get up every night, I would never have started to learn doctoring," unquote. In the latter half of the 19th century, there were 460 medical schools, most of them private enterprises run by practitioners who were less concerned with standards than with tuition fees. Students were required to take courses of 2, 4 to 6 month terms at about $60 a term, and often the second term was a veritable repetition of the first. These diploma mills, the result of the fusion, fission, and spontaneous generation, were manned largely by professors who had graduated from similar institutions. A few of the schools, particularly those connected with universities, had higher standards, although the demand of Dr. Charles Eliot for written examinations was rejected in 1869 by Harvard Medical School, with the dean's comment that a majority of the students cannot write well enough, unquote. Dr. Eliot claimed at the time that anyone could walk by Harvard, go in, and without further question be accepted as a medical student. Standards began to improve after the opening of Johns Hopkins Medical School in 1893, but on the whole, scientific facilities remain very primitive compared to those of Edinburgh, Leipzig, Germany. Surveying the medical symbols in the early 1900s, Abraham Flexner was assured by the dean of the Salem College in Washington State that laboratory facilities existed. "I have them upstairs," the dean assured him. "I will bring it to you." And he returned with a small blood pressure instrument. If diploma mills depressed the standards and quality of general practice, the medical profession as a whole appeared to have abandoned its humanitarian mission in the lust for money. Crowds of pure tradesmen is how Dr. L. Connor in 1898 described his colleagues to the American Academy of Medicine. Doctors had little professional prestige. Indeed, many were considered crude, coarse, and ignorant, contributing to the social butchery by keeping the patient ill. A city doctor's fees in the 1880s, $2 to $3 for office visits, $3 to $6 for house calls, suggested how lucrative a practice could be, and also why so many country doctors who got 50 cents for house calls deserted the farm for greener pastures. On an income of $10 a week, the average working-class family could hardly afford private medical attention. However, all things considered, this may not have been a disadvantage. America soon became known as a bastion of medical humbug, a reputation that prompted Oliver Wendell Holmes to declare, "If the whole materia medica as now used could be sunk to the bottom of the sea, it would be all the better for mankind and all the worse for the fishes." Surgery performed with the eclat of battle heroes. The general practice of surgery was leavened slightly by what might be called exceptional practice. Sound intuitive diagnosis and treatment by doctors of ability despite the rudimentary state of medical knowledge. The same held true of surgery. Occasionally sparks of brilliance on a landscape indistinguishable in character from that of general medical practice. The textbooks called the period surgery's heroic age, and while it did produce some dashing imaginative surgeons who made the indomitable cavity their playground, a question could be raised about who the heroes were, the patients or their doctors. American surgeons in particular had a reputation for too much dash, a lingering tradition of the Civil War hospitals, where amputations were performed in shocking haste, 40 seconds for a leg, without the benefit of anesthesia. However, in the beginning, even anesthesia proved to be mixed blessing, with totally unconscious subjects to work on. Surgeons became excessively daring, and their work actually declined in finesse. A general indifference to cleanliness, particularly during the kitchen table surgery of rural districts, increased the risk that the patient developed septicemia. While there is no evidence that the surgeon smoked during his labors, it is known that he did use instruments that were not always rust-free. His attire typically was street clothes, perhaps a frock coat with sleeves slightly rolled to avoid blood splattering. Sutures he kept strung through his lapels or, for great efficiency, between his teeth. Although Lister's antiseptic research was well known in the 1870s, it was disregarded by all but a few American surgeons. His carbolic spray to clear the operating room of germs was frowned upon, and even the great Dr. Samuel D. Gross, acknowledged as the Nestor of American surgeons, questioned the value of the Listerine principle. The death rate in the 1870s of 10% for all hospital operations was a large part a consequence of the after effects. There is strong evidence that President Garfield would have survived the bullet wound inflicted by his assassin, Gatew, in 1881 if Lister's precepts had been followed. But expert doctors called to the president's bedside were said to have probed for the bullet with their fingers and instruments that were far from antiseptic. The president died of the secondary infection. Such filthy procedure was typical treatment for accident victims, although whose begrinned limbs, wrote Dr. Stephen Smith, one-time New York City Health Commissioner, quote, the surgeon was apt to pass his knife, conveying to the deepest part of the wound matters of untold septic virulence, unquote. Hospitals. Hospitals quite clearly are not an element of the nostalgia for the good old days, and perhaps the absence of curiosity about them suggests a general suspicion that they were in fact dreadful places. Even in the criticism of modern hospitals, which often derives from our self-esteem having been bruised by functional coldness, there's not a trace of lament for the past, nor should there be. The hospitals, especially in the cities of the 1860 to 1900 period, were similar to the almshouses where humanity's castaways languished in appalling squalor. Essentially charitable institutions, they were the last resort for the poor who did not have home care. The rich and middle classes feared them as pest houses and remained at home when they fell sick, even having operations performed in a bedroom. Conditions at New York's Bellevue, which has a well-documented history, were typical of the old-fashioned city hospital. Today an institution of medical and administrative excellence, it was founded as a poorhouse near the East River, where the sluggish tides ebbed and flowed through the sodden soil of its foundation, depositing far more filth than they have removed. Rather than a health-giving resort for the sick, it became a focal point of epidemics, with outbreaks of typhus and typhoid fever in the 1840s taking the lives of half its patients. A New York society woman who confessed that in her life she had hardly known hospitals existed visited Bellevue in 1872, by which time medical services had improved. The loathsome smell sickened me. The condition of the beds and patients were unspeakable. The one nurse slept in a bathroom, and the tub was filled with filthy rubbish. The American hospitals, where Florence Nightingale's pioneering work was ignored. The title nurse implied no professional training until 1873, when the Bellevue Nursing School was established. Patient care was a common occupation for drunken women who were permitted to work in a hospital in lieu of serving a prison sentence. Patients well enough to be on their feet were also expected to do ward duty. Such standards of patient care, the total absence of hygiene and ward systems, in which beds were tightly packed on several floors, made most hospitals veritable death traps. among charity-minded doctors who complained about the conditions, a Dr. Dudley in 1899 described New York's Harlem Hospital as crowded at times as the lowest tenement. It is not unusual for us to have from 2 to 6 patients sleeping on canvas stretchers on the floor, outpatients assembled in a shack on the pier. I have seen hysterical women awaiting care, the doctor reported, while great ugly wharf rats played in and out of the holes in the crevices. Magnifying the inadequacy of the old-time hospital was the fact that the patients usually were very ill. Otherwise, they would never have considered to be in being brought here in the first place. And by the time many of them were admitted, accident cases were not treated promptly. Victims of ailments not caught in time, their chances of recovery had faded. Others deteriorated from hospital-related causes. Air so vitiated that it was hardly bearable to the healthy. Surgical methods, and that were fraught with hazards of septicemia and gangrene. The Mayo Clinic and Roosevelt Hospital, New York, which in the 1880s had some private rooms at $3 to $5 a day, were exceptions worth of mentioning. But these and other fine institutions did little to alter the judgment of the people at large that the hospital was a place to avoid, especially if one valued one's health. We're getting back into that a little bit with these various diseases breaking out inside the hospital because of the hospital. I knew one guy that got these sores on him that burrowed in and made a hole, actual hole in his back. And he caught it and he went into the hospital for one thing and he came out with that. He had a hell of a time getting rid of it. Mentally ill. The question of mental illness was bound up in dark suspicion, shame, and ignorance. Families hid a demented member as if he were evidence of sin. The poor creatures were kept in attics, in cellars. On Staten Island, a lunatic was confined to an outhouse so narrow that his flexor muscles permanently stiffened. They were totally misunderstood. Dorothy Dix, the staunch crusader for prison and asylum reform, was told, "They don't need any heat. They have no feelings. Those that were unimaginable violence or without family were committed to the asylum, where to all intents and purposes they no longer belong to the human race." In 1887, Nellie Bly, a young reporter for Pulitzer's New York World newspaper, hunted for a scoop, had herself locked up in a New York Blackwell Island lunatic asylum, sharing with the inmates the vile food, teasing guards and a regimentation fit only for criminals. In her book, The 10 Days in the Madhouse, she confessed that the place could easily have driven her to insanity, which no doubt had been the fate of countless of inmates who were not demented at all. The most frightening obsession for these unfortunates was the knowledge that they were imprisoned for life in a human rat trap, easy to get in, impossible to get out. Of course, our government operates much better now. They just throw them out in the streets. They don't even keep them in a hospital. They just dump them in the alleys. Thus did Victorian society handle the problem of the mentally ill, confinement instead of treatment, subjugation in place of sympathy. Scant application was made during the 1870s of the new insights into the human mind produced by psychiatry. Nor was any attention given to the warning of Dr. S. Weir Mitchell, the great Philadelphia neurologist, that the alienist is not a jailer. The asylums had some perfunctory medical supervision, but most doctors did not believe insanity curable. Consequently, the recovery rate was dismal. Prior to the Enlightened decision to put doctors in charge, asylums were staffed by laymen, indistinguishable from prison guards. who were under the command of superintendents, invariably such management was despotic, with the inmates receiving arbitrary punishment for what were considered willful outbursts. The widespread prejudice against the mentally sick, they were regarded as wicked or possessed by some evil, compounded their misery. No matter what their personalities, whether glum or silent or spirited, no matter how they behaved, even if they recovered and were trying desperately to show it, their captors accepted all signs as manifest proof of their charges were indeed crazy. New York's Bloomingdale Hospital, the lunatic asylum attached to New York Hospital, had a reputation for what the New York Tribune in 1872 described as the devilish ignorance, brutality, and lewdness of its management. The North American Review observed, after an investigation of the state's asylums, that the keepers were mostly shoulder hitters and that the institutions would disgrace Turkey with their filth, vermin, contagious disease, and food hardly less fatal than starvation. Life, instead, had a Dantesque quality, as the demented were tormented and the sane driven mad. In 1878, investigations of the New Jersey State Asylum revealed that in order to detect pretenders, the authorities customarily poured alcohol over epileptic patients and set them on fire. Treatments were cold baths and water punishment, which in the depths of winter involved tying a patient to the wall of his cell and dumping buckets of frigid water on him, which caused his head and shoulders to become partially frozen. A frequently applied cure, so-called, was the dietary, in other words, the hunger treatment. A description survives of patients at Ward's Island Asylum in New York City finally getting a meal after a period of applied starvation. Diminutive, dirty bits of meat, flanked by a ladle full of oatmeal, dark, nauseating in appearance. The women sunk their often dirty fingers into the mush and ate ravenously. But the most depressing, most harmful aspect of asylum life was the total idleness forced upon the inmates. The word boredom cannot fully express the interminable vacancy of their existence as they languished on wooden benches or barren floors, enveloped by shrieking harangues of their violent co-patients. These unfortunates were cooped up in threes and fours, as in Philadelphia's old Blockley Hospital, in cells barely 8 by 10 feet. Restraints were necessary, the keepers explained, to prevent rampages, but widespread use of the straitjacket to subdue recalcitrant patients was also an economic measure, being considerably cheaper than hiring extra personnel. Usually these procedures aggravated the conditions they were supposed to mitigate. Subtleties of the human behavior of degrees of illness were lost on asylum management. Whether man or woman, whether a drunk, temporarily disturbed, or even normal, but incarcerated through some legal trick, the inmate was damned to anonymity and faceless indifference. Leslie's Weekly in 1882 described a typical madhouse as representing the most soul-sickening sights, if not the most harrowing. The wild shrieks, the babble of confused sounds, and the vagrant eyes, the disheveled hair. Now, I can speak a little bit to this, because when I was working, I think that was after I got out of the Army, or maybe before. Anyhow, they had a county home here that's only about 2 miles from where I'm at right now, and it was a great big Victorian house, and on the one side of the house, the men were, and many were mental cases, and on the other side was the women. And I used to have to go in there and work on their television sets, and so I experienced firsthand these mad patients, insane, usually not dangerous, though. They were just simply like children and babbling and cradling dolls and all that kind of stuff, just like you'd see in the movies. But it really gave me an inside picture of what that kind of situation was. Since that time, they've done away with that home, and I don't know what happened to the patients, unless they turned those out on the streets too. Doctors of the period remarked on the high incidence of insanity in America in his article, Despotism in Lunatic Asylums. Dr. D.B. Eaton noted that insanity had become more frequent and more fatal at a ratio of increase far exceeding that of the population. And the causes of this increase were, according to Dr. George Beard's classic treatise, American Nervousness, the country's rapid growth, the displacement of people by the movement west, and the overcrowding of the cities. Now remember, much of this took place during the period of the robber barons, the super rich of the day, unfettered capitalism, when it was don't give a shit about anybody but just the wealthy rich. And this is why many countries gravitated towards socialism, and this country did too. But whatever the causes, the effects of asylum facilities were devastating. Although many new state hospitals were built in the 1890s, critics asserted that the more attention was paid to structural elegance than to improving conditions for the inmates. You've seen some of these buildings like that that were built in the late 1800s that had all kinds of gargoyles on them, and they were medieval looking. In fact, a lot of times the movies will show a horror movie about insanity and all that kind of stuff. They'll show, and ghosts, they'll show these old hospitals that actually existed. Drug addiction. That essentially American problem, drug addiction, has a longer history than most of us may suspect. Opium use, which had become a national habit as early as 1840, found its devotees in all classes and regions. An expert's estimate put the number of drug addicts at 100,000 in 1868, a year that witnessed a six-fold increase over 1840 in the importation of opium, from 24,000 to 146,000 pounds. See, the government was right in on it. An Ohio doctor claimed that in his town, addicts outnumbered alcoholics, and Lafidio Hearn described the drug scene in Cincinnati in 1871, walking along the streets any day you will meet opium slaves by the score. They are slaves, abject slaves suffering exquisite torture. Once in the letters of opium and morphia, they are, with few exceptions, fettered for life. A clergyman in the same city, unable to face his congregation without the support of opium, committed suicide shortly before his service. A mixture of ignorance and unhappiness and the susceptibility to quick palliatives were responsible for the growing addiction to opium, which, in Hearn's words, was settling down upon America and gorging its victims. Writers and artists and intellectual class were heavy users. A lot of this come from the despair of the working class, this absolute despair of the working conditions. And they turn to drugs, and a lot of people do today. You can imagine working in one of those great big factories where you had a monotonous job of putting one bolt into something all day long. That's all you ever did. So they either went to alcoholism or drugs. William James experimented with drugs, which gave him the most glorious vision of color and jeweled splendor unknown to the natural world. But he was philosophical enough to warn that drugs that bring man from the chilled periphery of things to the radiant core are in their totality a degrading poison. James Adams described a group of vagrant Chicago youngsters huddled in an abandoned building to seek relief from their wretched life in the euphoria of drugs. They stole from their parents, pawned their clothes and shoes, did any desperate thing to get the dope, as they called it. The drugstore sold opium openly then in pill form or as a laudanum by the bucket, in addition to all the kinds of habit-forming potions masquerading as cures. But the comfort these various nostrums provided was temporary at best and often fatal. Thousands of ex-soldiers were addicts, having acquired the habit as battlefield casualties in the Civil War, who had been given laudanum to alleviate their agonies. And for even the most innocent people, the danger of addiction was ominously present in the patent medicines that were popular and readily available. Many of these had a base of 30-40% alcohol apart from their opiate content, and were blamed on the high rate of drunkenness in America. Remember back when Coca-Cola used to put cocaine in the Coca-Cola? No wonder people loved Coca-Cola. A sip of Perunia had as much of a kick as a martini, and it was believed that more alcohol was imbibed via patent medicine than in the form of bottled liquor. Infants, too, were exposed to the dangers of drugs. No mother of the 1880s would be caught without Winslow's baby syrup or Kopp's baby friend, which was liberally spiked with morphine. Both medicines could indeed put the child to sleep, but at the risk of addiction for life. More from ignorance than greed, doctors abetted and often created the sinister craving by their careless prescribing of opiates. Now the doctors do it today with over-the-counter medicines. They do the same damn thing, which occupied about 75% of their medical bags. Drugging was almost the only kind of relief they could provide the sick, who in most cases would have been better served if nature had been allowed to take its course. The Narcotic Drug Act of 1909 demonstrated the federal government's concern, but the use of drugs remained very high, reaching it in pre-war World War I days for opium alone, per capita intake 18 times higher than that of Germany. The drug addiction of today, a most painful reflection on American society, had its origin in the good old days. Well, that's it for today. We'll go on with this. We've got a couple of chapters left. Next, we'll go into education. And so now I don't think you'll be too excited to go back in the good old days like the conservatives always talk about. The good old days. 14:05. We'll be back with you tomorrow on Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the Bunker.
To my world, won't you come on in? Miracles, I guess, still happen now and then. Step into my heart, leave your cares behind. Welcome to my world, built with you in mind. Knock and the door will open. Seek and you will find. You. Welcome to my world.